Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. Hey, today is a little unusual. First of all, you're hearing my voice, which has been rare the last few months. And secondly, the boys are together. Mike and John are both in Sydney. Hello, guys.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
So what's, John, what are you doing down there? What's happening? I know the shoot was last weekend. How'd that go?
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, we just wrapped up our first term at FX PhD, and we're getting set for our second term, which begins in a couple weeks here. And one of the hallmarks of our second term is a miniatures model shoot held at the Warner Studios at up in Queensland.
Yeah, it was a really great shoot. Wish you could have been here, Jeff, man. It would have been good.
Yeah, I've been working away.
It was great. The you know, every term we do various shoots for FX PhD, our sister site, and this is the first shoot for term two, and we were reconstructing, I guess, effectively, the Superman Returns pipeline. So we had the guys that did the miniatures for Superman Returns. We were shooting on the Genesis camera from Panavision, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, the whole time I was thinking, you know, Jeff should be here with his camera along with the
totally.
dozen other cameras that we had here.
We had the Milo rig. Have you shot much stuff with the Milo?
I shot one job with the Milo. I really loved it. It was so interesting. It was a very simple shoot that I was working on, just a product shot, really. But I was blown away by that thing.
You know, the thing that's funniest, we had the Genesis camera feeding a 444 10-bit signal back, and that's the footage that students will get to play with next term. But the funniest thing is when that Milo rig recenters and stuff, you can actually say to it, hey, leave the camera where it is and move the rig. And I don't know, it's the weirdest thing, isn't it? Like the camera hovers
totally
in three space and doesn't move, and the whole rig behind it goes up and down and up and down the tracks, and all the whole time the camera and the image that you're watching on the monitor is rock steady. It's weird as.
There's a great video of that online at Camera Control. Let me see. Let me double check.
Yeah,
this.
No, it was done by the guy who invented it, Mark Roberts, right, in London.
Yeah.
It's just we'll try and find it because it's the
CameraControl.com. I know they have a bunch of Milo videos and showing how it works. And yeah, the first time I ever saw the rig move and the camera stand still, it's pretty impressive.
It is.
You're just like, that is so serious engineering.
And we had Steve Newman, who was the DOP from Babe and Superman Returns miniatures and stuff. And he was giving the masterclass on lighting miniatures, and it was cool.
Yeah.
What I love about this is the whole concept of not only the interviews and the behind the scenes and the how-to stuff that we're able to shoot with these things, but then the fact that we're actually generating footage that the students can use not only for projects that they do as part of the class, but also for their demo reels. Having actual model footage, blue screen footage, you know, that's for their use for projects and for demo reel, I think that's just a killer part of the whole deal.
Yeah, that's one of the things that the first term postgrads have really liked a lot about FX PhD, and it's actually going to be a lot of fun in the second term to have all this footage available to them, this HD footage directly from the Genesis camera. So
yeah,
open up your bandwidth pipes. And
yeah,
plus
people haven't.
We got twice as many courses in term two as we had in term one, so it's growing rapidly.
Well, I think people really need to check out the FX PhD website because there's a lot of testimonials on the site now. The first term, everybody kind of had to take a leap of faith that we'd do great things, and it's reassuring now to see people who have took the first term with us now coming back and saying, you know, great comments, and, you know, just the feedback has been unreal.
Yeah, it has been really nice.
Great.
And
I mean, myself, I've been working so much and so busy that, you know, my ability to do classes and stuff has not been there, but I've been trying to keep up with the classes and watch everything, and, you know, kind of behind the scenes guy. And
I've
been blown away by the classes. I mean, just
the man behind.
Somebody's been influenced by you because one of the survey results had reason for taking FX PhD. Jeff Huser is my Lord and Savior.
Now, that's a frightening thought.
But in a moment, we're going to get onto this week's main podcast, which is the guys at Double Negative talking about World Trade Center. But before I get to that, I think it'd be good just to touch on some of the funky stuff that's come out in the last couple of weeks in our what is now 1 year, just over a year of doing these podcasts. It seems like a long time ago that we started.
It does. I remember Yeah, I'm doing them from the Rocky Mountains is, I think, where I was doing them. You were in Australia. Jeff was in L.A. And,
well, that's why I was so keen to get Double Negative on, because one of the first ones we ever did was that Batman Begins one, right?
Yeah.
And
I'm sorry, I'm just thinking about it. I finally remember listening to that, laying on my back in the pool in the sun in Durango, Colorado, listening to those first couple podcasts. And still one of my favorites. I think we talked about that a couple of weeks ago on our anniversary episode. But really like that. So it'll be great to hear this week's podcast.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
Yeah.
They're 1 year on as well. But I was going to say, out of SIDGRAPH and stuff, we saw a few things we posted, like the Light Stage 6, which you and I, Jeff, got to hang out on, which is cool.
Yeah, that was quite the evening we spent with Paul. That was great. I can't wait to see that technology in use more. And,
really cool.
You know, the next step. So, and God knows they haven't stopped. They won't stop. They'll just keep doing more cool stuff. So
that was actually the thing we were talking with some of the DOPs at the shoot, the FXPHD shoot this weekend, and their eyes were just like, "Wow, this is like we've got to check that out."
Yeah. And some of the stuff I was referring to that's come out recently, I think is pretty cool. I don't know if you guys have noticed this or not, but there seems to be a really amazing trend at the moment in the 3D tracking companies moving into 3D motion capture without sensors, in particular like facial capture without sensors and stuff. Like, it was the first step was like this: can we solve the camera? Yeah. And then it was like, you know, it's a move then, I guess, into object tracking and being able to track objects in the scene, not just the camera motion that filmed them. And now, like RealViz is a new product out. There's a couple that have come out at SIDGRAPH that are doing facial performance capture without markers. And I think that's pretty amazing. I haven't had a chance to use it myself yet.
No, but it sure sounds like, from what I've read about it, it really sounds incredible. So,
well, it seems like it'd be great for the kind of shot that turns into an effect shot that wasn't, you know, or some of the... As well as planned uses, just being able to do, you know, where you're tracking something into a face for, you know, more of a horror genre or something like that, where it might be really cool to make a transition from some real face to something. It seems like there's a lot of opportunities for that.
Yeah, and what's cool in light of the new Tower G5s that have come out, and I know we've ordered one here for the FX right. Guide office, is a lot of these things like Synthes and stuff are coming out as you know, Core Duo, multiple core Intel Max systems, which is good. So
I can't wait to see some real benchmarks on those too. I'm happy to see in the preliminary ones that I think I've got maybe 1 year left on my new Quad G5 that I just wasted my money.
So did you say new Quad G5? I think you mean your old pretty, Quad
yes,
G5.
Yes, exactly. But I think I can eke another 12 months.
Yeah, and there's my 8 and Max 9. How long before those two get amalgamated, do you reckon?
Yeah.
Maybe they'll meet together at 10.
Yeah, do you think so? And
new version of Learning Edition of Nuke, right?
Yeah, that's
the SIDGRAPH, I believe, as well.
And the one that I really like is Vue 6. As you guys know, I really like.
We had a article review that we did. For those of you who haven't noticed on FX Guide, be sure to check that out.
Well, that was the we had up, I think, 5, and we're about to post 6. And 6 is basically added some really interesting stuff in. For those of you that don't know, that Vue is like effectively a terrain environment creator. So if you go back a few years, remember when people used to get Bryce and make, you know, islands that never looked very good? Basically, Vue is basically a newer version of producing natural terrains for like matte paintings or establishing shots. And it doesn't do everything, but it does a heck of a lot. And in this latest release, what it's really done, which was badly needed, is increase the cloud volumetric rendering stuff. So now a lot of us used to fake that cloud stuff out by putting in alpha plane stuff, but now you can actually fly through 3D clouds as part of your you know, reveal of your establishing shot or whatever, and it's just awesome. And, you know, better terrain tools, better...
It's amazing how each of those versions makes a better step forward in that. I mean, there was always that thing. It's, you know, it's a somewhat computer-generated, but it really does keep getting better with each and every release.
And that was in Pirates of the Caribbean. They used that on the... what was that island that he was made a god of? But, yeah, so they... When he was... They were attacked, basically, by the... the natives, and offered up for dinner. A lot of the island shots had set extensions and wide shots done using that technology at Industrial Light and Magic. So that's pretty cool. So I don't know if you guys saw anything else at SIDGRAPH that.
Before we do that, we should also say that if anybody's working on a project and they've used, you know, if we do an article on a piece of software or something like that, and you've done some production work with it, you know, make sure you get in touch with us. Let us know. We'd love to add to the story or, you know, do another story on your project. You know, we always love to hear, you know, people using the software and how they're using it and, you know, follow-ups to these things.
Exactly.
So this week's podcast, World Trade Center is now out, the new Oliver Stone film. Some have described it as his best work. Others have described it as the least Oliver Stone movie that Oliver Stone's done.
That'd be a good thing.
Double negative. Well, you know, I really like Oliver Stone's work.
Too.
Yeah,
I do too.
Any Given Sunday is just way cool. Double Negative, oh, yeah. Giant Killer Robots and Animal Logic worked on it. We spoke to Double Negative for this story. And basically, if you guys remember, a year ago, we were talking to them about Batman Begins, and John Chicago was featured in that.
Yeah, they did an amazing job at building up a huge database, actually, of really high-resolution stills and HDR imagery in order to build their own Gotham, loosely based on some of the architecture and in Chicago, and they put that to use again.
Well, this time they tackled New York, of course, and there was like 500,000 digital stills made, and as John said, that was stitched into high dynamic range panoramas that were put together by a database. In other words, you know, you obviously could just stitch together images and you'd have a big matte painting, but what they were doing was causing the images to be HDRs first, then stitching them together, but in a virtual sense, so that when the 3D needs to access into the picture, depending on what resolution it's at, depending on how far away the camera is, it can dynamically load that massive matte painting. And what's interesting, I thought, is the guys managed to get a massive speed improvement. I mean, really significant, like it's many times faster 1 year later because they've polished the pipeline. Yeah, I mean, it's just weird. Yes. But the same kind of problem, just solved at a huge level. And so that refining process, I guess, was part of the work that that you'll hear about in a moment, because it was, you know, based on the stuff that they'd done before. But I guess in one sense, we'll be talking to Peter Beebe about that. And Peter was... on Batman Begins, and we'll talk about that part of the project. The other thing that's new, of course, is that and how vivid are those images? The clouds of dust and smoke billowing out of Ground Zero, and that was tackled by the dynamic supervisor Ryan Cook.
I also think that's an interesting angle that we talk about a little bit in the article, is the idea of having to recreate that in a visual effects film, because those are images that I think just about everyone, even around the world, remembers. And that's a really tough job to tackle, I think.
Yeah, you guys were watching that first thing in the morning, right, when it happened?
Yep.
Yeah, I was
just got into work and standing in kind of disbelief.
We were just about to go to bed here, and it came on. And I don't want to take away anything from the seriousness of the situation, but I must say that there was a universal comment made, and you know, in the context of the horrendous event, that when looking at those images at first, many people thought it was a movie. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but...
My father was actually in Japan and up in Sapporo and watching a Japanese television station, had no idea what he was watching, and actually thought that exact same thing because there was no English language channel there.
Yeah, so, so when you get those incredibly powerful images that are so well known, that are iconic, really... trying to reproduce that is just no small order, and you know, they are big shots. These are not, you know,
right.
But of course, for sensitivity reasons, the guys couldn't film most of that in New York because, I mean, obviously it'd be pretty ghastly to be recreating some of the horror in New York, especially for residents, even if it is a film shoot. So not only do they have to reproduce the scale of Ground Zero. But, you know, they had to do it in Los Angeles.
I was wondering where they shot.
Yeah, there's some really nice high-res set extension shots we've got, you know, before and afters. We'd like to get those, you know, original plates of what the guys had to work with in final shot, so you can judge for yourself.
Love those before and afters.
But, I mean, Ryan comments on it, I think, it might have been Pete, that they really are pretty seamless. Like, it gets to a point where I just look at them and I just buy it. I mean, I just totally buy the set extensions and stuff that they did. So it's excellent work again from Double Negative, who've really been growing in the last few years as one of the major effects houses, certainly in Europe, but you know, obviously smaller than maybe an ILM or a Sony ImageWorks, but definitely right up there in one of
and
the...
And really doing really good quality work.
Yeah.
It? Yeah.
So we're going to go over to that thing, but before we do, just, you know, so good to hear you on the air, as it were, Jeff, as opposed to just...
Every time you're on, Jeff, someone sends us an email saying how great it was to hear your voice.
Well, I wish I could do more. I've been at Hydraulics now for a year and a half, and wow, it's been...
Well, you have been doing some great stuff, good films in your
exactly.
own right, dude. So, you know, it's
yeah. like it's been a ride, but it's been great, and I love it, and commercials and features, and but as you know, that can swallow you up.
Well, we've been swallowed up a bit ourselves in this last week, I must admit, with the shoot, but if you want to check out the stuff we've been talking about with FXPhD, just go over to fxphd.com, where we have, I think, 14 courses this term, professional high-end training courses. In a moment, you'll hear the interview with the guys at Double Negative, and we're going to thank them for that. And some of the other stories, the SIDGRAPH stuff and the 3D tracking stuff, will be coming on the main site in coming weeks.
Well, why don't we go ahead and join your interview with those guys now, Mike?
So, Pete, thanks for joining us.
That's all right, no problem.
So you actually worked on Batman almost exactly a year ago, didn't you?
That's right, yeah.
Which actually was one of the first podcasts we ever did, almost one calendar year ago. And I guess I need to ask you, this seems to be a remarkably similar pipeline. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. The pipeline is very similar to the Batman. But in this respect, it was all daylight buildings we had to do for this project, so it's ever so slightly different.
And so in the scheme of things, you started on the basis of taking still photography of New York, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right, yeah. We went out there and just did a recce, sort of referring to the storyboards and seeing where we had to concentrate the actual coverage. And then we do, yeah, the same as before. We did multiple exposure, sort of tile photography of the facades of the buildings. But whereas in Batman we did a slightly different approach. We did a lot of three-quarter angles, and we covered it a lot more because the storyboards weren't so concise. So this we could actually sort of half the time we actually took. But we still ended up taking 500,000 photos, so it's a fair amount of coverage. Because always you have to kind of cover yourself for if the director does change his mind and wants to shoot a different angle. So that's what we tended to do with that one.
So you were fairly well storyboarded on this, like you really knew the material and where you had to build. But of course you had to replace stuff that wasn't there, and most notably, of course, the World Trade Center itself.
That's right, yeah. I mean, we knew that the majority of the action was going to be kind of held in two streets, the Church and Vessey, and that was what the set that they were going to build in the LA lot. Obviously, due to that, I mean, they did want to film in the same area, obviously, where it was, but I guess because of sensitivity and the fact that it's still kind of very apparent in a lot of people's minds there, that they just couldn't get permission to do that. And obviously, having papers spinning down and screaming people, it's not really appropriate. So a set was built of Church and Vessey Street, a small area outside what was Building 5 in LA. So we then basically did set extension from that. So we knew that sort of area was where the majority of the action was going to be taking place. So that's where we did a lot of the coverage for the photos and stuff.
How similar is that area now than it was before September 11? Has it changed?
Not a huge amount, no. I mean, the roads got slightly... slightly smaller. It was like a sort of four or five lane sort of road just outside the Building 5 there, but apart from that, nothing much has changed. A few shops are slightly different, but apart from that, no, it's very, very much the same.
So let's walk through the pipeline. If you are trying to recreate streets in New York and skyscrapers, you're taking digital stills. Were you shooting, like, what, on the Canon 10Ds, or what were you shooting on?
Yeah, it's the Canon 10Ds and 20Ds. And then we basically, what was apparent that we sort of optimised the timeline this time was the fact that we waited for diffuse conditions, because a lot of the time for Batman, some of the photography was taken maybe in direct sunlight or even at night time and stuff, and a lot of touch-up had to be done, and that took an awful long time to do. So we waited for diffuse light conditions on this, and we were quite lucky in that respect. So a lot of photography was done with quite flat lighting, so the actual touch-up for the texturing wasn't that much. So we covered quite a lot from that point of view. But then once all the multiple exposure tile photography is done, we also also, along with that, we did total station data, which is like, I don't know, you know, it's a theodolite, which is like a surveying tool, which we take sort of key measurements of the building, which helps with the sort of photogrammetry techniques we use later on in the pipeline to actually build the building.
So you are still piecing together basically bracketed exposures on something like, what, a 50mm lens or something?
And then... Well, it depends on, again, on what coverage was required. For the buildings that we're going to be quite close to, with the possibility of even grazing past, we were doing tile photography on a 100mm lens. The majority of the time, it was a 50, and then for the sort of panoramas, the sort of slight background, it'd be 24, something like that, but it's all prime lenses. The amount of detail that we got in those buildings, sort of in the immediate sort of Church of Vessey, were quite extreme. You could actually get very close if required.
So when you took those photos back to the office, you put them into what is Super Browser? That's your thing for collating and stabilizing and producing the OpenEXR base files?
That's right, yeah. I mean, basically, as we were taking them, we were having them on disk and shipped over, so by the time that the actual team got back, they were all digged together, basically. Yeah, I mean, it goes into Super Browser, which takes all the raw data in, all the multiple exposures, and then sort of lines them all up, takes the lens distortion out, and then outputs something called an EXR format, which is a multiple exposure format, which allows us to actually take the building almost down to black, and then back up to sort of clipping the whites. And then that goes into, and then that puts into something called STIG. Now, the difference here was we had auto STIG written for this, which means that we take out the manpower side of it, so it's all done automatically. But so there is no joining of this bit's this bit, and that's bit, and then, you know, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. The auto STIG just does it all automatically, as the name suggests.
But
so the actual tile photography, getting it as one sort of single image, the entire building was done in quite a short amount of time.
But am I right in saying that even when you're stitching that together, you're effectively stitching it together in metadata? In other words, you're stitching it together so that you'll be able to build a database of how those HDRs go together, or those OpenEXRs
right.
go together?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And then from that, your 3D pipeline is only pulling out the data that it needs rather than getting swamped on sort of 50K files. Is that how
that's
the
texture
right,
yeah. What it does is when it comes to the rendering of the image, basically it just picks up, yes, the actual data, and however close you want to get, it just picks up, renders the detail as required. So when you're doing a tiled image of a facade, which is, you know, 3K images and it's 8x3 or whatever, you can get quite a big picture from that.
And so
the details all there, yeah.
So you need to stitch this stuff together, but also, of course, you need to produce geometry, and you said you were doing some measurements. Were you then building the geometry that you texture mapped or projected on based on the measurements, or were you doing the kind of deriving photogrammetry stuff from the stills that were done?
It's a combination of both, really, the best of both worlds. The key measurements we took with the survey data allowed you to just have somewhere to start from, and you knew that certain areas were that high. And, of course, that aids in the photogrammetry process, because if you know a door height is this big, then you can then stick that in, and then from all of that, then you can actually rely on the photogrammetry a little bit more for all the subtle details. So if you have survey data of all where the window positions are and the door positions and the actual height of the building, you stick that in, and then when you come to do the photogrammetry process from it, and you can then build all the subtle detail in, you can build all the window frames in, you might be able to build some of the sort of architrave stuff around windows, and that's it proved to be a lot faster than actually trying to just rely on either one or the other technique.
And is that where the Emery vision stuff comes in?
Well, Emery vision was a term coined on Batman because it was one gentleman was doing it called Emery. He was doing it all the time. It's just 2.5D environments, which isn't so much it is photogrammetry, but it's multiple production, multiple sort of projections. It's more like 2.5D side of it, environments, really. So it's not really, no, this is
more 3D,
more photogrammetry, yeah.
And tell me, on the Batman Begins stuff, one of the things that you deal with was the night illumination of the lights, and of course this film was set, or at least starts, in the day, because it was a...
That's right, yeah.
Did the interior of buildings feature in your issues? You used something called Window Box last time, didn't you?
That's right, yeah. We used Window Box again for this. Obviously, again, we optimised it a little bit more to make it faster, and we were very... keen to get actual room environments, which are the correct room environments for each building, because we're getting so close. Whereas in Batman, we took generic office building environments. For this, we got permission to actually get the correct environments for each building. So where you have on the Church and Vesey Street, the law offices, we actually got permission to go in there and shoot the specific rooms. So when you did look in the building, it looked correct. But yes, again, that process was taken, so it's very quickly to do, so you don't cause that much inconvenience to the people. So you just go in with a tripod, or even that, just take sort of a curve plus minus two stops on a fisheye in the room, and then you're done. And then you take that back, and then you undistort it, and there's your environment for the room.
But it's not as simple as just putting that, theoretically back behind the glass, is it? Because doesn't
it's not at all. No, there's it's a little bit more technically involved with that. What it is it calculates the position of the camera where you're looking, and it maps it into a cube. So, I mean, without getting too technical, it's basically you're looking at the room, and it gives you the correct sort of angle for that perspective, basically.
So if you were flying past the building looking through the windows, you'd actually see the natural sort of movement inside.
You'd see the room move, and the only things that which would give it away, and if you really got close, is say if there was a big light fixing like a chandelier coming down in the middle of the room, you'd see that was actually mapped onto the back almost.
And
so certain things like that, you can only get so close, and then you have to start building the interiors. But that's not really an option for the amount of buildings we had to do. So it was on a shot per basis really. If we needed to build an environment for actual room, then we'd do it. But we never found that we needed to do that. Window box actually holds up very well.
You mentioned earlier the falling paper and stuff, as well as I was wondering, did you have to come up with anything new over the rubble and the dust and especially the dust, I guess, and the smoke plumes? Because it was really an incredible. I myself watched it live, and it was not really when the buildings collapsed. It was the smoke and the billowing of it that really defined the event.
We've got a lot of in-house tools for all of that. We have our own sort of rigid body dynamic solver now called Dynamite, and we have our own sort of 3D voxel renderer called DNB. So a lot of the stuff was actually controlled by that, and it's the paper. A lot of sort of proprietary tools are written for that as well. So there was a lot of specific stuff done for this show in order to actually, because as you say, a lot of people saw that, and it's still fresh in their mind, and you can compare and contrast the two, and you get, we continually had video of the particular scenes that we were trying to recreate, so we could try and match them sort of inch for inch, really. So it's very difficult. A lot of the techniques that we used were a combination of our philosophy was try to get much done as quickly as possible to get feedback to the client. So there was a lot of 2.5D in there, and then it was taken over to 3D where absolutely required. But if we had to shoot our own little elements, then we could do that as well. That side of things is done by my companion Ryan. That's sort of the whole dynamic side of it.
Was self-shadowing an issue with the clouds? I mean, getting density in the clouds? I mean, the smoke was. What were the main issues there on that?
From what I know for that, I don't think it was. No, there was a huge amount of the actual rendering time wasn't a problem. It was the dynamic simulation stuff which took the time, because some of the shots we started quite low and we were right in the thick of it, but then we're pulling out quite high. So it was the combination of keeping the resolution in the actual simulations as we were pulling out. But we managed to overcome that with combining different elements in 2D and comp and stuff. But the render times for that sort of thing were quite quick. It was just the simulation times which proved to be quite involved.
In fact, we're only 12 months on from when you did Batman Begins, and the pipeline allowed you to produce shots at a much faster rate, didn't it?
That's right, yeah, it did. But that was morely for the building pipeline stuff. I mean, the buildings for this were very quick. We could turn around a building in sort of 3 or 4 weeks, if that, less than that in some cases. So the building pipeline was pretty much optimized for this.
You were rendering at 4K, weren't you? Were you rendering at 4K?
4K for the majority of it, and even higher in some respects, certainly for the towers, to overcome the mooring effect that we had. But again, because it was so quick, it wasn't really an issue.
So when you do the 4K frames, what point do they go down? I mean, do they go 4K, and then they get downsampled to 2K at the film recorder, or are you outputting it? I mean, how does that work?
It's depends on the shot, really. I mean, if certain elements are required to be rendered at 4K, then they'll go to comp at 4K, and then yes, it'll be downsized then to full up 2K for output. But in certain instances, that was required. So, take for example the towers that we had, the terrible sort of mooring effect. We knew we'd get that, and we kind of tried to start cheap with that in order to try and overcome that with texturing like a cube, which is basically what it is. And then because we were getting closer, then you want to see detail, and that's when you had to sort of up-res the model, and that's where it was actually rendering geometry. And there was no other way really with that. We tried various other different sort of solutions, but because we had a similar sort of problem with Batman for the Wayne Tower thing, that we knew that there was a solution to overcome it, which was just to up-res and just take the hit for the rendering. But to be honest, I mean, that wasn't that bad for the tower shots.
So you needed to hit an astonishing level of realism on all this stuff, as you said, because everyone knows it. What would you say you were most successful at, and what would you put that down to?
For me, I mean, obviously, because I was just doing the building side of things, the actual set extension stuff from the stuff they did at LA was the most successful for me. Because you just don't, I mean, for me, you just don't notice it there. You take it as real, and that was the most important thing. It doesn't come out to you as a 3D environment. It's just in there in the background. And of course, then you're just complementing the story. You're concentrating on the actual action in front of camera. So, I mean, that was the most successful for me, I think.
How long did you have to work on the whole project for?
All in all, it was just over a year, I believe. I think, yeah, 12 months, I think.
So the initial reviews have been really strong, and one of the reviews particularly highlighted, there's a pull-out shot that starts after the collapse and goes right up. Can you talk us through that shot?
Yeah, sure. I mean, initially, the pull-out shot was on the cards, and it was never actually sort of agreed to until sort of halfway through, and it was going to be three parts and cut out a lot earlier. But so you had it coming out from a techno crane shot, which was actually going to be at the LA set, the Ground Zero set, and it comes up, and then we were just going to carry on the camera, which we did. But with that, the initial sort of the trailer shot that we did for that, we tried the 2.5D approach, but we found with that, because of the complex nature of Ground Zero debris and all the twisted metal and stuff, that we'd had terrible parallax issues with that, and we were tending to find that we were painting quite a number of frames to project back on. So we had to sort of take a hit with that. There's always going to be the backup of actually starting to build 3D geometry for that, which you had to do. So we got out there onto their set and scanned a lot of the debris and took pictures of it and stuff, and then recreated that and used that as in the actual pull-out shot. So as we're coming out, that's all a combination of actual plate and 3D.
The final renderers, were you using an in-house renderer, or were you using RenderMan, or what was the...
Yeah, it's RenderMan. It's all RenderMan. All our stuff's done through that. We've got our own sort of interface between Maya and RenderMan called Rex. So, yeah, it makes it very simple to set up scenes. It's entirely sort of... It's very user-friendly in that respect.
And then were you compositing in Shake?
Yes, in Shake, yeah.
And the whole film, you delivered your shots, and then I guess basically the question is, when did you finish? Because the film opens August 9, I believe.
Yeah, we finished sort of mid to end of June. Basically, we're still sort of addressing final comments, but yeah, it was mid June basically that we pretty much rounded up with stuff. So yeah, I think it's because we had a few, like the helicopter shot, for instance, came in right at the very end. So we turned that shot around in 6 weeks, which is pretty good going, I think, for the work that was required for that shot.
Yeah,
the helicopter shot was basically a slow shot around the Woolworth Tower, showing the aftermath on September the 12th, the morning of, which is a sort of a combination of real plate that was shot and the 2.5D and sort of 3D approach again combined into that one.
So from you getting that shot, you turned it around in how long?
In 6 weeks, from receiving of the plate to match moving it to doing the painting, the 3D, the smoke, and the painting, the matte painting stuff as well, was 6 weeks for that.
So on a shot like that, I mean, how many people are working on it directly? I mean, obviously a lot of people in the company working on the pipeline.
We had a team the 3D side for that shot of probably around about 6 to 8.
And tell me, if you've only got that amount of time, how much toing and froing is there in the last week on approvals and stuff?
Not a huge amount. But I think with that shot, they knew the thing we could do there is we could get concept stills of where we'd be, and we tried to get as much back to the client as we could. So within receiving the plate, match moving it, within about a week and a half to 2 weeks, we were sending basic stills or sort of 2 or 3 second renders of where we think we'd be. And the client got back, and there's nothing but praise of that shot. So we basically, there wasn't much change in there. That's all. So yeah, it went through quite smoothly, that one. Very happy with it.
Well, it looks spectacular, and I'm looking forward to seeing the film. I've certainly seen the trailer and some of the stuff they've released on it, and the reviews have been spectacular.
I think it's very important with this sort of thing, Mike, that with these films, it's not an effects-led feature. It's there. The effects just are there to supplement the story. So if you can't notice they're there, then that's great. You know, it really helps, and it's a compliment to us and the team, really.
Yeah, and it is such a sensitive issue to so many people, you would be torn to shreds. In fact, I think the critics were almost preparing to rip the film to shreds on the basis
and of course, it's such a... I mean, Oliver Stone is noticeably JFK and stuff with conspiracy theories, so he'd be a slightly odd choice for a director, but for this, he's gone straight, truthful approach to it, and I think it's just worked really well. I mean, I haven't seen the film, I've seen a bit of it, but I think it's remarkable. Yeah, it's a very good film.
I must admit, I really like many of his films a lot, and like Any Given Sunday is one of my favourites, and I'm really looking forward to it. But as I say, your job was so difficult because it's so vivid in so many people's minds. Well, thank you so much.
I think it'll prove a success, to be honest. I mean, I was worried about United 93 because that's quite a hard-hitting film as well, being that sort of John Greengrass, I think, is the director for that. It's very hard-hitting, and I think if the public could actually, you know, go with that, then I think the WTC thing was going to be okay as well, really.
Well, United 93 really was from a completely different perspective, wasn't it? I mean, it was the whole thing wasn't something we saw. It wasn't something that was etched in our minds because
that flight really
happened off the radar, as it were.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Whereas what you were dealing with was just completely etched into popular culture.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's iconic now, isn't it? Some of the sort of the news reel footage of the towers and stuff. So, yeah. It's very important that we match that perfectly, and I think, you know, looking at it now, it's not a bad job. I mean, the reviews that I've read about the film so far have been all about the emotional side of it and the recreation of it. Nothing about the effects at all, which is great.
Yeah, if ever there was a case of your job serving the script and the story, this is it.
Yeah, so if there's nothing mentioned about the effects at all, then I'm happy. You know, I'd rather they say that they're not good at all, to be honest. I'd rather them just concentrate on with the reviews on just the, you know, the acting and the story and sort of the emotional content of it, really.
Well, thank you for taking time to walk us through it. We really appreciate it.
That's not a problem.
So as we talked about in the intro, I really find it interesting the idea of having to create effects for something that has been seen by so many millions of people around the world, and being a U.S. film, for those of you outside the States, it really had a gigantic impact on the psyche of the nation at that point in time, and as that scene was played and replayed just hundreds and hundreds of times. So really, really quite challenging to bring that kind of effects work to life. This becomes really evident also as well in the second part of our podcast when Mike Seymour talks with Ryan Cook, who is the dynamic supervisor, having to build all the smoke effects and so forth coming from the towers. And those effects really just had to be sold, and so the story could be told, as so many people know what the actual shot looked like. It really is become an iconic shot. So let's go ahead and join that interview that Mike had with Ryan Cook now.
And so we've heard about the work that was done on the rigid body, the buildings and the landscape, but we're now joined by Ryan, who worked on a lot of the simulations, the smoke and the debris. Thanks for joining us, Ryan.
Thanks, Thanks, Mike.
So let me just back up a second. You actually joined, where were you before you joined the team there at Double Negative?
I was at Industrial Light and Magic before coming here. I moved to London about 3.5 or 4 years ago.
And your area of expertise is really, or the area that you focused on in World Trade Center was a lot of the stuff to do with the CG dynamics, the smoke, etc. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. Pete Bebb was kind of led. We split the show between the two of us, so Pete did a lot of the set extension, and I kind of led the effort on the effects and dynamic side of things, so smoke and kind of debris and shrapnel.
So were you on set at all yourself?
I actually didn't get a chance to go on set. Mike Ellis and Pete Bebb were sent to New York and Los Angeles, and I kind of stayed back at the ranch and did some setup from this end.
So how much research or how much development work went into setting up the... because the cloud, the visuals that we have in our heads from the real event are those blooming white clouds, both from the burning debris before the buildings collapsed and, of course, the massive debris once the buildings collapsed. How much was that a development effort for you, and how much was it just taking the tools that you already had in-house?
We did a huge amount of development for the show. That was from the beginning, probably. I mean, just knowing the sensitivity of the project and the fact that, you know, basically every person in the world has seen those in, like, now iconic images. It just seemed to me that it was going to be the most difficult thing that I'd worked on. A lot of the R&D effort was led by one of our senior developers, Jeff Clifford. Jeff Clifford had developed DNB, which is our own proprietary voxel rendering software, which was developed on Batman: The Intimidation Game. Sorry, Mike, I'm kind of stumbling here. I'm trying to remember what I talked about before.
Let me give you an intro question, and you'll probably just start all over. So I was asked. I'll just start again. So let me ask you this: how much R&D, how much actual development work went into producing the now incredibly vivid images we have of the towers collapsing in terms of the smoke, and how much of that was stuff that you already had in-house? Because those images are so well known, and that's the thing that was before they collapsed, the burning, of course, and then once they collapsed, those massive white pluming clouds of dust.
Yeah, Mike, we did an incredible amount of R&D work for the show. We have our own proprietary voxel renderer, which is called DNB. That was developed by senior R&D programmer Jeff Clifford for Batman: The Intimidation Game, which it was mostly used for, like, doing sort of geysers and smoke plumes, like, in Chicago. It was completely rewritten from the ground up, basically, for, like, memory management and efficiency, just to be able to handle. Like, we had just, like, several orders of magnitude larger kind of simulations that we needed to render. I think just, like, the really sensitive nature of the work, and, I mean, that combined with the fact that, I mean, they're so iconic that everyone in the world has seen those images. There wasn't a lot of room for error. John Sheely and Oliver Stone early on kind of provided us with, you know, loads of images, reference images, and stock footage that we knew we had to get pretty much, and, you know, an exact match for. So Jeff began by just trying to go through and making the renderer a lot more efficient and being able to handle more memory. But he also broke it down into, like, a pass management system, similar to, we have one called Rex that we use for all of our RenderMan renders. So we were able to just kind of have multiple simulations in the same scene and be able to swap out, like, different types of shaders and lights to just, you know, cut down the amount of time.
Let me ask you a question, though. On the way you approach a shot, let's say we've got a shot, it's going to last, I don't know, 10, 15 seconds, and you've got very specific reference of what the pluming white smoke or dust is going to be doing. Are you approaching that from the point of view of trying to most accurately create the environment so the simulation will run and therefore produce what you saw from the reference, or are you trying to say, how can I build this to get the smoke to look like this, and therefore I'm going to set off multiple separate things and piece them together? Because you can set up a simulation and have it accurately simulate only to as good as its sort of input parameters. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I think, yeah, definitely the former. We started early on developing just a library of simulations. One of the other like R&D projects that we did was a really fast like OpenGL render, like a plugin for Maya. So when we did have the simulations on disk, we could just place them as though they were models. That's something that we haven't had before. So with that, like we by building up a huge library of different types of simulations, we started at the beginning saying, okay, well, there's this plume, there's this type of smoke that might be coming off of, you know, like a certain part of the impact zone. So, and we would just set off like 15 or 20 of them, and we were just maxing it. I mean, we set the entire render farm at a double negative for weeks, just kind of generating as many of these as we could, and then picked the ones that, you know, the best ones, and sort of went from there. And then once it actually came to, like, once we started receiving plates, we were able to kind of pull those into Maya and lay them out and get kind of as close as we could to like the stock footage with the fact that they were simulated and they would never be like exact, but it enabled us to get as close as we could.
So it was more of an art direction matching problem than it was trying to get the exact environment right, so that because you did actually have a very accurate map of the area and the structures, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. Are you speaking like specifically about the debris on Ground Zero or the plumes and?
Yeah, I was actually meaning the aftermath of the collapse.
Yeah, with the aftermath, we had. We had LIDAR data that was provided by the U.S. government. Actually, had LIDAR the entire set the location of Ground Zero. So we had pretty accurate topography data and the kind of the major pieces. So a lot of those were kind of hand modeled and hand placed based on the LIDAR data.
Tell me how.
And then a lot of it was just we created sort of, you know, 35 or 40 different types of debris that were then kind of we could paint in and build up the sort of levels of debris like throughout this, the like put certain types of debris and amounts and things like that. We could just go in and paint texture maps and create that. So
how soon after September 11 was the LIDAR scan done? Was it once they'd done a lot of the cleanup, or was it relatively early?
It was done, to my knowledge, it was done within a week or two of the collapse. I mean, it certainly included all of the buildings that were brought down, like 3 and 4.
Yeah.
So it would have been done within 2 weeks of the collapse. I'm not sure if it was part of the rescue effort or I mean, I'm sure it was done sort of to be able to go in to start the cleanup. I think they needed as much information about as they could just for the safety of the workers.
I mean, it's tremendous that you got access to that information because, of course, prior to the film coming out, there were critics and I think many of them have been silenced after the previews, but there were critics saying that this was, you know, a film that really had to be incredibly careful of the subject material, given the sensitivity of the you know, victims and families of the victims.
Yeah, I mean, that's something we all felt like very early on. It's just, you know, I mean, it's definitely the most sensitive thing that I've ever worked on in visual effects. So to be able to, you know, I mean, from the beginning that we had been able to read the script, so we knew how sensitive it was, and that it wasn't, you know, it's a story of a rescue and about sort of people, you know, like surviving against all odds. So I think they'd, I mean, I'm sure that Paramount sort of did everything that they could to kind of, you know, get that information across to people, and as people started realizing what it was, and that it wasn't trying to be controversial, like what the sort of idea of the story was, I think doors started swinging open a lot more than certainly they were in the beginning.
And tell me, can we shift now to a couple of the really amazing shots of the film, not least of which is the pullout? Can you describe that shot for us?
The pullout shot is actually a series of three shots. I mean, John Sheely on set, like it begins, I guess, to describe the shot briefly, is it's kind of maybe two-thirds of the way through the film. It's just after the second tower has collapsed, and the camera sort of pulls up from they're not sure what's happened. They think they're in the concourse. They know there's been they think there's been a bomb of some sort, but it's only the sort of parking and like concourse area that has collapsed. And so it basically is giving, sort of putting into perspective like where they are. The beginning part of the shot is a crane shot that pulls up from the set in Los Angeles out to maybe sort of 30 feet above the ground. Our job was to sort of continue that out, do a set extension back to like to New York, and pulls up right up above basically the surrounding buildings of World Finance Center. That cuts into the second part of the shot, which is a map view that is sort of looking straight down at the plume going off across sort of Manhattan and into like the continental U.S. And then the third shot is a satellite. So yeah, I mean it was definitely the most challenging shot that we did. We started it pretty early on, and it basically combined like all of the research and development that we'd done on the show to sort of, yeah, I mean, just because the camera travels so far and we see everything from so many different sort of viewpoints, and it was an incredibly complex shot. I think there were over 250 elements, like rendered elements, that went into just the very first segment of that pullout shot.
Was that probably the most data-rich or data-dense shot that you guys handled?
Absolutely, it was the that one, and there's one like very, very near the end of the film that's a helicopter, like an aerial shot of the World Trade Center set, the World Trade Center sites, right? Between those two are definitely probably the most data rich. And yeah, I mean, it's just extraordinarily complex. Like the fact that because we pull up out of the ground, it wasn't just sort of your like a power of two shot where you see, you know, you can blend between map paintings. Because the camera's moving on an arc, we just weren't able to do that. So it's just an extraordinary amount of data.
And really, that helicopter shot, if I understand it correctly, wouldn't have been possible in the time frame from what we learned from Pete, unless you'd actually done the pullout shot, because you're basically repurposing your database on that, weren't you?
That's correct. There's that shot. I mean, that's one that we wanted to do from the very beginning. Like we I kind of felt that's kind of the crowning achievement of the work that we did. And I think we turned that around in maybe like 2.5 or 3 weeks, which is, I mean, because it was shot so near to the end of the film that we got to play it. We were all pretty positive about, like, we definitely wanted to do it, but the fact that we turned that around in the time that we did, I don't think any of us would have thought would have been possible when we started the project.
So let me take you down to an individual element. I mean, because I think this is obviously it's a problem of building blocks. Can you walk us through, like, if you're the guy, the animator or the artist who's sitting down to tackle one of these debris shots, for example, what are they like? How interactive is it for them? You mentioned before there was a plugin for Maya. Just walk us through the stages that would go, and if you could also touch on the approval stages. At what point anyone saw that work?
Well, I guess. We had John Shealy came out to visit the layout part of it. I mean, everything started from, like, we had so much reference of the site and aerial photographs and things like that. So it was something very specific that we needed to do. So, like, for example, the aerial shot or the pullout shot. A lot of the, I mean, Jordan Kirk and Allison Wortman are like two of our, like, the artists that were doing a lot of the layout part of it. I think any of the, like, based on the LiDAR data and reference photos, we were able to kind of place the sort of really big, obvious, like, you know, like points of across the site. And then, so those ones would be placed in by hand, and then Pete and Mike or John Shealy, when he was out, would be able to just kind of do an interactive session and lay out sort of the main parts of it. The majority, I mean, there were millions of pieces of things that were sort of piled up on each other. So the majority of that was just done with a particle system where we could go in and paint. We would have the terrain map of Ground Zero. We were able to go in and just paint regions or use an occlusion path from like buildings where we needed things to be piled up. That could just be used as an emission map where we would kind of like grow the like debris, the bits of particles over the surface. So it's probably maybe like on the pullout shot, there would be say like 60 or 70 like pieces that were kind of of hand placed, and then the rest of it was just was grown, like kind of emitted from a surface. Or in some cases, we also have a proprietary dynamics system that's based on the open source software Open Dynamics Engine that was developed by Peter Keim. That in some cases, like in the very close-up ones where we couldn't have pieces of debris that were intersecting, we would use that to just kind of rain things down and it would stack up in the near ground. So as much as possible, we didn't want to, you know, we tried to avoid having to hand place anything. We tried to do as much as use as much procedural animation and layout as we could.
But you were rendering very high resolution, weren't you? I mean, this was not this was a high res pipeline for you.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the most geometry I've ever seen in a RenderMan, like in a RenderMan render. It was it was all instanced geometry where we tried as much as we could, but just the nature of the camera move was quite complex. It sort of, it's hard to see it just because it moves quite slowly, but the camera actually, you know, it lifts up out of the debris that they had on set, and then is blended into like a previs camera that does kind of an arc up out around the building. So, and there was just an incredible amount of parallax in the objects and especially in the near and mid ground. That we just couldn't get away with any other way other than having actual geometry there. It just didn't look believable.
And how was that, putting that together? Because was it so complex that you pretty much had to get it nailed in the render? Or was it really during the compositing stage there were just, you know, tens or hundreds of layers of separate elements being put together?
I definitely have to hand it to Griff Owen led up the especially for the middle section of the pullout shot is one of our lead compositors. They're definitely, because we had to travel such like an incredible distance, especially once the smoke all started getting layered in and, you know, like floating ash and bits of paper and things like that. But we fly through so much volume that at some point, you know, we weren't able to do proper like holdouts for things. So yeah, there was definitely a lot of work from the 2D side of things, trying to like layer in like elements and like blend in smoke elements with like different sort of live action like elements that we had to kind of make everything work together. I think he did a really brilliant job.
And away from the big shots, there are of course set extension shots, and again a huge level of realism is required, because you know it's a very gritty film. This is not a stylized film. And how hard was it getting the realism in those set extension shots, and where you were just adding, you know, falling paper or additional smoke, etc.?
The work was done so. I mean, we were really blown away when we started getting the plates in. The director of photography, Seamus. The actual set stuff that we had from Los Angeles was pretty incredible to begin with. So, and we were lucky, really lucky in that respect. The hardest part was just being able to match what they had accurately. One of our lead texture painters and matte painters is Gwen Lydiard. Did a brilliant job on a lot of that stuff. And then we have our two effects CDs, Eugenie von Tunzelman and Will Elsdale, kind of where, you know, we did a lot of kind of fitting in buildings and bits of debris in the background, and then layered up smoke on top of that to match the foreground. The set extension stuff, I think, was really successful. So not only on Ground Zero, I should mention too, one of the main problems that we had was, because it was so sensitive that we weren't able to film anywhere kind of below, you know, like below Canal Street was they just didn't have access to. So things like that, like putting in the paper and getting the buildings to sit in there, I think we had people here commenting that they couldn't believe that they were effect shots, or they didn't know what was an effect in the shot, like some of the background buildings and things we're quite proud of. So.
Yeah. Look, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this question as well. Having worked at ILM and now at Double Negative, how do you find the work ethic, the approach of the English VFX crew versus the American VFX crew?
I'll have to be careful on this one. they're very different. Like Industrial Light Magic, you know, is especially when I was there. Like when I came to Double Negative 3.5 years ago, I think we were only there were 38 employees here. So we, in terms of having the research and development group, you know, at ILM to pull from, was, you know, it was quite a shock for me to come. Like it's a very like people here just get things done, you know, that you don't have the, at least it's like 3 years ago, we didn't have the massive kind of like R&D budget that you were able to put into something. I think especially Double Negative, that's changed just within the last like two, I mean since Batman the Intimidation Game, you know, we have a R&D group with over like 30 people now, so it's I think we're catching up pretty quickly, and it's a lot different, but it's I quite enjoy being in London. I guess more than anything, it's probably less specialized. You kind of have to have more of a full spectrum. People tend to be kind of a little bit, have a broader scope here than maybe in California. So
yeah, I mean, clearly both facilities are excellent and world class. I guess I wondered how true the cliches are. Certainly when I was working in London, I did really find, you know, the English approach to be different from the American approach and yet equally professional.
Yeah, definitely. They both have their advantages, I guess, like the longer, the sort of the larger number of shots and things like that. They're very different approaches, I think. Kind of equally high levels of work come out of both situations, but for me at the moment I think I prefer the English approach.
Well, thank you so much for taking time out for your presumably extremely hot English summer
to talk. Yeah, it's to us. Very uncharacteristic.
And again, congratulations on the film and you know, dealing with such incredibly sensitive material so well. It's no doubt going to be an incredibly important film, and I hope it's recognized as such.
Okay, yeah, I definitely do too. Thanks very much, Mike.
Really fascinating stuff. I haven't seen the movie myself. I've been traveling around the world and traveling down Australia for the FX PhD shoots, but I'm really looking forward to seeing the film when I get back to the States. And it's really telling that the critical reviews have really been quite positive about the film as well. Thanks to Pete Bebb and Ryan Cook for taking the time to talk to us. Coming up in our next podcast, we'll be talking a little bit about the Panavision Genesis camera. It's an interview we recorded on the set of FXPHD's shoot in Queensland recently. So we hope you enjoy that. Until next time, for Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.